Now, another programme in our special season, The A to Z of Dr. Johnson, as the comedian Sue Perkins finds out the story behind the publication of Samuel Johnson's English Dictionary of 1755. Although traditionally seen as the point at which our language was first defined, it was most certainly not the first dictionary. She begins her exploration of this literary milestone in a square just off London's Fleet Street as she goes in search of words, words, words.
Preface. Something spoken introductory to the main design. Introduction.
So I'm standing at the entrance of Gough Square, and the first thing that strikes me is this fantastic statue of Hodge, and Hodge is Johnson's cat.
Cat. A domestic animal that catches mice.
What I love is someone's left a sugar mouse for this beautiful cat and also tied a fantastic burgundy silk ribbon around him. So the cat is still loved in perpetuity, even though Johnson has long gone. Walking across just a really lovely cobbled street, approaching the four-storey house. There's lovely shimmering windows. The glass is all handmade. It doesn't have that sort of perfect, neat, reflective sheen you get with modern glass. Oh, there's a big old door.
House.
Oh, they don't make them
a bad. Place where inner man lives. A place of human abode.
Stephanie, hello.
Curator. From the Latin. One that has the care and superintendence of anything.
Now, how many locks and bolts and various things did you
have
to unlock?
A fair few protecting Dr. Johnson's house. On the back of the door, we've got these two big bolts.
Yep.
We've got this rather wonderful heavy chain that goes across the door.
It's a real Jacob Marley, that one.
And it's secured by a corkscrew latch, which basically means thieves couldn't use a fishing rod or some sort of similar device to unhook it. You have to use both hands to unwind it.
So why is a gentleman of letters who basically writes dictionaries having to secure himself in a fortress?
Well, there was no police force at the time, but it's also protection against the debt collectors. Johnson was never particularly rich, even though he got a good sum for writing the dictionary, because it took much longer than he expected. Actually, the year after it was published, he got arrested for debt. And, of course, in the 18th century, you get carted off to the debtor's prison just down the road in Fleet Street. So this door and this protection was also against the debt collector.
So now writers are paid just a little bit at the beginning and a little bit more in the middle, and then they're paid on completion. Whereas, I suppose, in Johnson's time, he's just got a whole load of money and just gone mental.
Partly, but it's also because he expected it to take him 3 years and it took him 9 years. So anyone, however good your budgeting is, you're going to run into problems at the end of that. And he also had to support his amanuenses or his clerks that worked on the dictionary. He had to buy all the paper and its materials.
He had a wife at home, he had a wife that he had to look after.
He had to support his wife. She actually, for the last few years of their relationship, went to live out in Hampstead, where the air was supposed to be cleaner, possibly still is, I don't know. But yes, that was really an expense they couldn't really afford on his wage.
I think the air in Hampstead is more expensive. I don't know if it's cleaner.
Yes, certainly more expensive.
Cover these white floorboards.
I think part of the reason he chose this house, and he rented it, so he paid about £30 a year for rent and bills, was because of the garret at the very top of the house, which basically is a wonderful workroom, and there he had room for all his books, his clerks that were helping him, and it's a lovely working area. So I think that's why he chose this house. It was also just around the corner from his printer, William Strawn, and the dictionary was such an enormous affair that it had to be printed in sections. No printer could have actually printed it all in one go, so the manuscript was constantly running between them.
Publisher. One who puts a book out into the world.
So this, who's this rather august fellow? The great man, I'm assuming.
No, this is actually a portrait of Robert Dodsley, who, another great man, but was instrumental in commissioning the dictionary. He led, really, the seven booksellers that clubbed together to commission that dictionary. And he'd previously published a poem by Johnson called London. And so he knew what Johnson was capable of. And it was probably his influence that persuaded the other booksellers to employ Johnson for this task. Although we should note that plenty of authors previously had written about the need for a new English dictionary. So people like Pope and Dryden and Addison had all been campaigning for the need for one. But yes, it was the booksellers that got that money up front and commissioned Johnson and made it actually happen.
And presumably they knew they were onto a good back-end deal. They thought, oh, this dictionary could catch on. Every home could have one.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And they'd be right, of course. So walking up the very creaky steps. I tell you what, this house is Farrow and Ball's dream.
Stairs. Steps by which we ascend from the lower part of the building to the upper.
So I've just walked up to the first floor, and here I'm going to meet Henry Hitchings, who's the author of The Extraordinary Story of the Book That Defined the World. There he is, loitering magnificently.
Loitering with intent, of course.
Biographer, a writer of lives, a relator not of the history of nations, but of the actions of particular persons.
This is a guy who was the son of a bookseller, a provincial bookseller in Lichfield, and he grew up in a house which was effectively like a research library, probably 2,000 or 3,000 books there. There's a story about him once looking for some apples that were drying on a high shelf, and he knocked a volume of Petrarch down off, and he thought, well, I'll read this now that it's fallen on the floor, and off he went. And that kind of background, to get that kind of infusion of literariness, of knowledge at a very early age, was obviously, you know, instrumental in guiding him in that direction.
We're standing in front of these imposing portraits, presumably of his fellow sort of denizens of the sort of Grub Street area.
Well, we've got up here David Garrick, his Lichfield friend, and of course really the greatest actor of the period. And Garrick came with Johnson to London in the first place. They were completely penniless, really had no idea of what they were going to do once they got here. Johnson, because of his large physical bulk, it was suggested he might find work as a porter at Covent Garden. In fact, what he ended up doing was some sort of fairly kind of low-rent journalistic work. Garrick quite quickly made an impression on the London stage, and I think much as Johnson liked Garrick, he was rather aggrieved that someone who was, as he put it, a mere player could achieve such note and distinction. And while that wasn't a source of resentment, I think it was something that occasionally rather flummoxed both Johnson and his friends, that here he was, this sort of literary titan, and yet he spent most of his life really struggling financially. And I think it's quite important to recognise that the impetus for Johnson's dictionary didn't come from him. He was approached to do it, and the fact that there was real money on offer, £1,575, which I think in modern terms is probably equates to about £200,000. That really was the big stimulus, although of course the money went very quickly because he wasn't on expenses like a nice Member of Parliament.
So why is it at this precise moment in history they pick on this precise character to produce the definitive English dictionary?
Well, I think the moment in history is, first of all, worth sort of talking about. This was an age where there was an explosion of print culture. So for the first time, you got things like printed tickets and posters, lots more books, magazines, newspapers. And as things get written down more, so there's more of an urge to codify and to standardise and to have works of reference. You know, you've got other things which are of a very different nature, like the British Museum, which are coming into existence at very much the same time.
He must have felt, on a purely personal level, the need for a dictionary, bearing in mind that some of our European counterparts had one.
Yes, I mean, the two sort of really big dictionary projects had been the French Academy had been set up, and its 40 members had taken 55 years to produce a dictionary. And then there was the Accademia della Crusca in Florence, which had also produced a dictionary. So there was a sense that this was a pressing requirement, because it was terribly embarrassing that the French had their dictionary.
They've got fewer words, though.
Well, that is true, although at the time I'm not sure that would have been recognised. But Johnson really was the right person in the right place, but there was a degree of happenstance about that. He knew a lot of the powerful booksellers through his other sort of Grub Street activities, and one thing that they recognised was he had the capacity for hard work. When he was recording the debates in Parliament, for example, for the Gentleman's Magazine, he would sometimes write 10,000 words a day. You know, just physically, that's pretty difficult. So he was someone who'd been identified as having the right temperament, but also the right kind of work ethic.
Lexicographer, a writer of dictionaries, a harmless drudge.
So when one thinks of somebody who compiles reference books only, you think of a sort of possibly a sort of fusty, dry, pedantic academic. But Johnson really wasn't of that ilk, was he?
He wasn't. And while obviously he had to be very rigorous in his approach to making the dictionary, there were a lot of times when he sought relief from that. He was a tremendously sociable person. He would take people into his home. He took in a blind poet called Anna Williams. He would take in sort of down on their luck prostitutes and the general sort of scurrilous literary characters of London. There's evidence that possibly at the time he was writing the dictionary, his favourite drink was nothing stronger than lemonade. But he definitely liked to go out and to carouse, to have a damn good time. But he was also sort of convulsed by this terrible melancholy disposition which ate away at him. I mean, there were so many different things going on in his mind. His great biographer, James Boswell, describes his mind as being like an amphitheatre where the beasts were constantly converging on the middle. And there's this sense that he was being assailed from all sides by different anxieties, anxieties about his work, anxieties about the health of his wife. He had these secretaries or amanuenses working for him, mostly Scotsmen. Johnson had rather a dim view of Scotsmen. He said, much may be made of a Scotsman if he be caught young. probably sort of 99% of his definitions are thoroughly sensible. But it was quite characteristic, really, at that time to smuggle in little jokes.
So I suppose a late-night lemonade moment.
I think we've probably all had that when we were working hard and we wanted to cheer ourselves and thought, no one will notice this.
I've certainly had the late-night lemonade moments, but I've never managed to produce a reference book of any note whatsoever, I have to say, so he's beaten me there. I think it's probably a common error to think that Johnson's dictionary was the first. I certainly thought it was, but as I found out earlier at a visit to the British Library in the company of Karen Thompson, antiquarian book specialist, don't you know, that this is pure misunderstanding, a mistake, a mix-up, a slip, a confusion, an error, a lack of comprehension, a misinterpretation, a failure to understand and interpret.
Library. A large collection of books, public or private.
We've got a number of really early dictionaries from the British Library, all of which are long before Johnson's work. And the earliest book that they've sent down for us is this fascinating volume by Mulcaster, Richard Mulcaster, the first part of the Elementary, and this is 1582.
And then it goes on to say it's the writing of our English tongue, T-U-N-G.
Yes.
Set
well
forth.
Noted.
Yes, yes. Oh, look, Fiddling Stick is in there. Tickle, T-I-K-L-E. Great.
And Mulcaster's particularly interesting because he was a northern man. He was born in Cumberland. And his vocabulary is full, in fact, of northern words.
Fabulously got thwack, which is a word that makes me think of an opening Yorkshire batsman thwacking something over the boundary.
So it's not a dictionary because it doesn't explain what the words mean. It's just a list. The first English dictionary, this little book, and little, you know, this is the operative word, it's very slight, by Robert Cawdrey, of hard words. And it was designed not to include words like frying pan, which were not hard words.
So you're saying there'll be no thwack in here?
I don't think you'll find thwack in here,
right.
No. It's specifically for the benefit and help of all unskillful persons, which would have included, of course, women.
I wonder if the word patronising features.
But he's trying to be helpful. I mean, he's written this book in order to help us, so that when we come across words like pervicacy, and we think, ooh, what's that?
Sounds like a skin disease.
Stiff-neckedness.
My goodness, I've never even heard of that word.
No, well, it may not exist. It's perfectly possible that it doesn't.
You can't just make up... Well, of course you can make up words.
And lexicographers did. And what's more, the next lexicographer puts it in his dictionary as well. And then it becomes what's called a dictionary word. It doesn't exist outside dictionaries.
The modern equivalent, I suppose, would be Wikipedia, where somebody sitting in the room in their pants makes something up, puts it on the internet, and 10 minutes later it becomes fact and used by every journalist in the country.
Absolutely. So. Just something else I'll point out about this book, a table alphabetical, he calls it. He's deliberately using the word alphabetical because this is a list of words in alphabetical order, and that wasn't necessarily an obvious concept at the time. So at the very beginning, he explains how to find words in the list. If thou be desirous, gentle reader, rightly and readily to understand and to profit by this table, then thou must learn the alphabet. And where every letter standeth as B, near the beginning, N, about the middle, and T, towards the end. You know, you may think this is obvious, but it wasn't to Cawdrey's readers.
Hmm. So it's a new way of cataloguing.
And, well, listing words was a pretty new concept, and, you know, this is the way you find the word you want to find.
So, from 1604...
There was the second English dictionary was called an English Expositor. Yeah. Again, explaining hard words, which had maybe twice as many words as Cawdrey's. And the third one was a particularly interesting work by Henry Cockerham, which goes one stage farther. And you might want a copy of Cockerham on the tube with you, because he divides his dictionary into three sections. And the first section explains the hard words. The second section does the same list in reverse. So you look up December and you think, oh, hypocrite, that sounds a bit smarter. That's the word I'll use.
So instead of being a sort of French to English, English to French dictionary, it's a sort of clever to less clever.
Yes, exactly.
Less clever to clever.
And less clever to clever.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the third section is proper names and tells the story of important heroes from classical literature, but also has funny animals in and so on. And I think...
That's like the light relief.
Exactly. I think this was really written to entertain you. So I think that's the one you want on the tube.
Yes, if every reference book came with a sort of list of funny animals at the end, you'd find that the British populace would be an awful lot more educated.
Yeah, we'd be much keener on reading dictionaries.
So, from Cockerham...
So next we come to Thomas Blount, who was a rather more serious gentleman. He was a lawyer.
No animal stories in this one.
And again, he's talking about hard words, but he's also including other things. Words that had come into London because of all the tradespeople that were active then, and the vintner, who will furnish you with Montefiascone. You don't know what these are, so he's supplied the words to his dictionary so you can know what you're being sold.
So this is more comprehensive, it's more scholarly,
yes.
It's less readable as a result.
Yes, I think it is slightly less readable as a result. Mm. And he's, I think, the first lexicographer to quote authority. So Blount's dictionary was first published in 1656. Then we come to 1676 and Elisha Cole's English dictionary. And again, it's hard words, but he is also including dialect words and also slang words, particularly cant, which was thieves' slang. He excuses himself for including the slang and cant words in his address to the reader.
Yes.
It may chance to save your throat from being cut, or at least your pocket from being picked. In another slang dictionary of the period, lully prigging is to steal the washing off hedges. So, you know, your good lady is drying all her washing on the hedges and the lully prigger goes and pinches it all.
I'm delighted with that.
And it doesn't, in fact, happen until the 18th century that you really get a universal dictionary. And through the 18th century, there were dictionaries published by Nathan Bailey, two folio dictionaries, and they had all the words in the English language in. So you'll find words like cat and dog, and although he just describes dog as an animal well known, it's there. And as your Johnson experts will know, it was a copy of one of the folio editions of Bailey's dictionary that Johnson used as the sort of starting point for his dictionary.
That's been a fascinating tour. So I've now made the heady heights of the second floor of Samuel Johnson's house, and it's proven to be a veritable workout. And here to meet John Simpson, who's the editor, the chief editor, in fact, of the Oxford English Dictionary.
Editor.
Hello, sir. Nice to meet you.
Publisher. He that revises or prepares any work for publication.
Stephanie's loitering with more keys, poised over what I think is the first folio of Johnson's English Dictionary.
Indeed. It's one of the first editions.
Have you seen this before, John? Is this old news for you?
I haven't seen this particular volume, but I am familiar with the dictionary.
Now, that is quite something. So sort of half a metre long, that fantastic yellowed paper, crackly surface.
Really, I mean, it's a beautiful dictionary, and we try and make dictionaries beautiful today, but what's important from a dictionary point of view is the form of the entries. Mm-hmm. He's got the head word, here we've got the head word for to burn. He's got that in a separate sort of type. He's got an etymology in square brackets. So if you go to a dictionary nowadays, you'll find the etymology in square brackets.
So it'll tell you where it's from, where it originates, whether it's Saxon or Greek.
That's right, yeah, that's right. And in this case, burn being a word with many senses, or a number of senses, he's divided the verb to burn into four different senses. And many of these features were around in individual dictionaries before Johnson, but he brought them all together. The point is, this is a sort of melting pot of all the best ideas about dictionaries.
I think it's such a beautiful thing. I mean, I still love dictionaries to this day. I'm not denigrating the modern dictionary in any way, shape or form. But I can just get lost. I can get lost in all the tiny definitions.
If you look at the word carbuncle, which is a word that's come up in the news in the last 20 years or so, you can see he's defined it as a jewel shining in the dark, like a lighted coal or candle. I mean, it's almost poetic the way he's describing that. I mean, he's got a second sense, red spots or pimples breaking out upon the surface of a body. If you look at earlier dictionaries, such as Bailey's dictionary, you'll find much more constricted, workmanlike, journalistic definitions. Whereas this is sort of laid back and classic and timeless. And he also supplements his definitions with these quotations from what he called the best writers of the previous 200 years. So he's citing Shakespeare's Coriolanus under Carbuncle. He's also citing Milton's Paradise Lost.
I guess now, if you're doing Carbuncle, you'd have to include, obviously, Prince Charles' feelings on architecture for any building post sort of 1860, I guess.
Yeah, you'll find that in the OED entry for Carbuncle, in fact. Yeah.
Really?
So you do try and keep up to date.
Very, very good. I'm delighted to hear it.
Success. The termination of any affair, happy or unhappy. Success without any epithet is commonly taken for good success.
So this 9-year labour of love gets published. How is it received?
It's extremely well received, especially by the educated book buyer, which is what the booksellers wanted, because it contrasts with Bailey's Dictionary, which was much more of a sort of journeyman dictionary. Even now, we tend to use Johnson's spellings rather than the variation of spelling in the early part of the 18th century. And it's become a standard form for what the dictionary should look like.
So finally, we're heading to the top floor. The secrets of this house unfold themselves with every new layer. And the top floor, the garret, is of course where the dictionary was compiled by Johnson and the six or seven people that were helping him.
Amanuensis. A person who writes what another dictates.
Oh, they were fit in those days. Ah, you can see why you'd write a dictionary here. This is a fabulous room. Light and airy. Fabulous big desk. So is this the desk they'd all sit round, Henry?
I don't think it's the actual one, is it, Stephanie?
No, this is an interpretation by a contemporary artist. It's sort of a monument to the scribes that helped Johnson write his dictionary in this room.
So we know there were six or seven scribes. How much more do we know about them apart from their Scottish heritage?
They're all rather obscure figures. They're classic Grub Street figures, really on the margins of society. And Johnson really, I don't think, chose them because they were particularly good at the kind of tasks involved, but really because he was taking pity on them and thought they needed the work. I think one of the main benefits of the secretaries was that they provided him with company. I mean, if we think about this room, it will have been absolutely sort of scattered with paper and bespattered with ink, and it probably won't have been that light and bright because the whole city will have been under a sort of terrible pall of smog.
Choked with it.
Of course, there'll have been candles guttering in the room, and there'll have been probably animal fat candles exuding a most unpleasant smell. It wouldn't have been a particularly congenial working environment, so to have other people to share that with will at least have alleviated some of the more sort of noisome dimensions of it.
See, now I'm imagining a sort of penumbra with sort of tallow and tea reek coming off it, and not so nice, you're right. But listen, he compiled the dictionary in 9 years, which is no small feat, bearing in mind how long it took the Academy in France to come up with theirs. How did he do it? What were the nuts and bolts of the composition of this reference book?
Well, the nuts and bolts was that he would do this reading, and he would, every time he came across a word which he thought was being used in an orthodox way, he would mark that down, and then the secretaries would transcribe the quotation that he'd found, and they would then create a kind of skeleton dictionary out of all these transcribed quotations, which were on little slips, and they'd arrange them into alphabetical order, and Johnson would provide the definition and the etymology. The problem was that they started after a while pasting all these slips into books because they got a sense of what the dictionary was going to be like. Then they realised that the approach Johnson had to the number of meanings available was too rigid. So that essentially had to be discarded and he had to start again from first principles. But I think we have to think about him doing a lot of reading. There was a lot of transcribing going on, a lot of pieces of paper flying around. It's inevitable that mistakes are going to creep in when you've got this sort of, I mean, just real kind of, I can't think of the appropriate word, perhaps sort of tsunami of paper or something like that, cascading across this room.
Tsunami. Oh, well, I haven't got that one.
What's interesting, and you make this point in the book that you write about Johnson, is that he approaches a dictionary with the mind of a reader rather than an etymologist or a lexicographer at the beginning. So it's an entirely literary pursuit, and then later it shifts to become much more a cataloguing of the varying meanings of words.
Yes, he starts out with a very rigid sense of how many. He thinks no word can have more than seven senses. And we can think of lots of words that only have one or two, but actually,
relationship, for instance, has about a million meanings.
I think it has about 6 billion, doesn't it, actually? But yes, I mean, I think the verb to take, he ends up deciding, has 138 different meanings. And yeah, the parameters shift. I mean, when he starts out, the idea is very much to send the language to school, to kind of almost to embalm it. But actually, over the course of his work on the dictionary, he comes to realise that one of the things which is important about any language, and certainly about English, is its vitality, its mutability. And one of the things you need to show is the kind of the copiousness of the language, rather than trying to confine it almost within sort of steel bands.
And that's something that's thankfully carried on today, is that the dictionary is being updated constantly, different sort of global sources, street vocabulary, slang. Is it still, John, a drudge to fix sort of language in this way? Is it still as complicated now as it was for Johnson back then?
Well, it's very interesting what Henry was saying, because it felt very much like a description of what working on the OED was like in the 1970s when I first went there. We were sitting in these little garret-type rooms with our angle-poise lights and index cards and materials and trying to write definitions to go with these cards, etc. But actually, it's fascinating. I mean, the nice thing about working with words is that you're, at least as far as the OED is concerned, you're really social historians through words. So for any word you're working on, you're looking at what it means now, obviously, but what it means in the past, what its etymology is, why its etymology is appropriate for the time when the word first came into the language, how everything fits into a sort of network for the particular word.
So you don't have any amanuenses now, kind of scurrying around?
Again, I was very interested in what Henry was saying, because we've got 60 editorial staff working on the OED. I don't think they were taken on just to keep me company.
Achiever. He that performs. He that obtains... What
satisfaction.
The act of pleasing to the full.
Or state of being...
successful. Release. Prosperous. Happy. Fortunate.
For a reference book, this has more authorship to it than any other book I've ever read.
Absolutely, and one of the most important things about the dictionary is the innovation of using these quotations from literary texts. And actually what Johnson does inadvertently there is he compiles an incredible anthology of English literature and really actually kind of foments the idea of what English literature is. You could almost say that Johnson is the inventor of an idea of English literature.
Yeah, I mean, Henry's right. Johnson's dictionary is where a lot of factors came together and formed the basis of what dictionaries were to become in future.
So with the completion of this dictionary, is the completion of his masterwork. I mean, how did he go on to live with this huge tome kind of hanging around his neck? Was it an albatross, or did it allow him to have a better quality of life?
It did ultimately allow him to have a better quality of life, but the key thing was really 8 years later when George III awarded him a pension of... a sane George III, I should point out, awarded him a pension of £300 a year, and that really freed Johnson up. But really, what's terribly depressing is that for a number of years after the dictionary, Johnson was in a state of penury, and indeed about 4 years later, he was arrested for a debt of under £5 and had to be bailed out by one of his literary friends, Samuel Richardson.
The English dictionary was written with little assistance of the learned and without any patronage of the great. Not in the soft obscurities of retirement or under the shelter of academic bowers, but amidst inconvenience and distraction, in sickness and in sorrow.
It was only when he'd done it and reflected on it and wrote the preface, which was the last thing he did, which is a magnificent piece of English prose, but I think he was able to reflect with pride on what he'd done, rather than with the sense that it was this kind of cripplingly drab undertaking.
I have devoted this book, the labour of years, to the honour of my country. Whether I shall add anything by my own writings to the reputation of English literature must be left to time. When I am animated by this wish, I look with pleasure on my book, however defective, and deliver it to the world with the spirit of a man that has endeavoured well.